This is lecture 2 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness. Lecture 2 is entitled The Three Worlds and Their Reflections. If one wishes to form a conception of spiritual research, one must, first of all, gain a concept of different states of consciousness that are possible to the human soul. In the ordinary life which man lives on earth today, in this age, he is in a perfectly definite state of consciousness. This state of consciousness is characterized by the fact that man experiences a certain distinction between the waking and the sleeping state, which harmonizes, approximately, even though not exactly corresponding in time, with the passage of the sun around the earth, in reality the rotation of the earth on its axis. To be sure, the order of things to which I am here referring has in our day been somewhat disturbed. But if we look back into times not very remote, when life was systematic, we find that man generally worked approximately from sunrise to sunset, and slept from sunset to sunrise. In our day, this has been somewhat disturbed. Indeed, I have known persons who reversed the thing, sleeping by day and remaining awake at night. I have often inquired after the reason for this. Then the persons concerned, those of my acquaintance were for the most part poets or men of letters, have said this practice belonged to the art of writing poetry. But on no occasion when I have come upon these persons at night have I found them engaged in writing poetry. Now, this is precisely what I should like to point out, that for the present day consciousness, the most important fact is that one remains awake during the period of sunlight, so to speak, or for a time corresponding in duration to this period, and is asleep for a period corresponding in duration to the night. But very much besides is associated with a consciousness that has such an experience. Connected therewith is the fact that men place a very definite value upon sense perceptions. They consider sense perceptions to be the most essential reality. And when men pass from sense perceptions to ideas, they feel that an idea is merely something that has been thought, something not so real as our sense perceptions. Man looks upon a chair today as something real. He can thrust it against the floor. He also hears this. He looks upon this as something entirely real. He knows, moreover, that he can sit on the chair. The idea of the chair does not seem to him something real. If he strikes the idea which he believes he holds in his head, he hears nothing. Nor does he believe, and he is quite right for the present constitution of man, that he can seat himself on the idea of a chair. You would all certainly be dissatisfied if we had placed only ideas of chairs in this hall for you. But much besides is associated with this experience of a consciousness that conforms with the sun. Such was not the case with these men who received their instruction, the impulses to all their life relationships, from the mysteries, for example, the Chaldeans to whom I referred yesterday. The life of these men, even in their consciousness, was entirely unlike that of the men of today. First of all, I can draw upon an externality which will make clear to you the distinction between the human consciousness of that age and that of today. With our reckoning of the year, counting a year as 365 days, we are not entirely successful. If we should continue to count thus through the centuries, always counting 365 days for a year, something would finally result quite out of keeping with the solstitial points. We should fall behind the sun in its positions. So we do this. Every fourth year we insert a day. Then we come out approximately in harmony with the positions of the sun in the course of very long stretches of time. How did the Chaldeans manage this in their most ancient period? Not as we do. For long stretches of time they had a reckoning corresponding to ours, but they arrived at it in a different way. Since they counted 360 days as a year, they found it necessary after every sixth year to insert a month, not a leap year each fourth year like ours with an intercalary day, but an intercalary month after 6 years. Thus they had 6 years of 12 months each, and then 1 year, the seventh, with 13 months, 6 years with 12 months, and again a seventh with 13, and so forth. Note that present-day scholars record such facts. They say it was so. but it is not known that such things were associated with radical modifications in the states of human consciousness. Those men who did not insert a day every fourth year, but inserted a month after 6 years, beheld the world quite otherwise than we do. Why? Because they did not by any means feel this difference between day and night as we do today. They did not experience, as I indicated yesterday, such clarity and luminousness by day as do we. If anyone with the present-day consciousness stands here and looks down into the hall, he sees men thus, well, as you know, with sharp outlines. In some cases they are more widely separated, in others closer together, etc., but one sees men with sharp outlines. Such was not the case with those who received their impulses from the ancient Chaldean mysteries. It was quite different with them. Every one at that time saw this. At that time one saw men seated, if I may now use this picture, not as we sit today, such was not the practice then, but one saw men seated surrounded by an auric mist, which was considered a part of the man. And whereas today one sees in such Philistine fashion each man sitting sharply outlined on his chair, and the whole thing appears in such a way that one can quite conveniently count, in that time one would have seen in such fashion that the left and right blocks of seats would have appeared in a sort of auric cloud moving like a gas, here a cloud, there a cloud, and then darker places, and these darker places would have indicated the persons. Not in the later, but in the earliest Chaldean period, one would have seen this picture in that fashion. By day, only the places within the auric mist forms would have appeared dark. At night, one would have seen something very similar, and even in the sleeping state, for this was not so deep at that time as it is now. It was more dreamy. One would not have seen this as one would see it today. If someone were asleep today and you were all seated here, he would see nothing whatever, even though you were all seated here. Such sleep was at that time not attained. But even in sleep one saw the dream form of the auric clouds left and right, and within these the single persons as light forms by day, dark within the auric cloud, by night light forms in the auric cloud. So then, there was at that time no such great distinction in perception as exists at present between the relationships of day and those of night. So likewise men did not then experience the distinction between the sun in the heavens and the sun absent during the night, but they experienced the facts in such a way that they saw the sun by day as a globe or a disk of light, round about it, however, a wonderful solar aura in a fashion that may be represented somewhat as follows. And there is a blackboard drawing, but not in the book. Men had the following mental picture. There beneath is the earth, with water over it, everywhere above and still higher, snow lying. From there overhead, they imagined, came the Euphrates. Then they thought of air as being above all of this. They saw the sun passing overhead, encompassed in a wonderfully beautiful aura. The sun went this way, from east to west. Men then conceived that something existed of which one might say in a certain sense, as one might speak today of a tube. In the evening, the sun goes into this tube. In the morning, it comes out again. But men saw the sun inside this tube, and they saw the sun by night somewhat as follows. In the center, a greenish-blue luminosity, and round about, this yellowish-red. So did men conceive the sun. In the morning, coming out of the tube, in the center bright and enclosed round about in an aura. It passes across the dome of the sky, slips into the sky in the west, into the tube, becomes darkened, has an aura, however, which rays out beyond the limits of the tube, and thus it sinks farther beneath. Men spoke of a tube, of a cavity, because indeed they beheld the sun darkened, black. Men expressed what they saw. Thus when men looked up to the sky with its sun, they did not perceive so clearly defined as today the distinction between day and night. On the other hand, men saw something else at that age very distinctly. A man would look back at his childhood. He had completed 6, 7 years of his life. Then he would see himself still actually encased in the divine in which he had been before descending to the earth. He would see himself between the 7th and the 14th year slip somewhat out of the auric spiritual egg, slip out still further to the 20th year. Only when he was in his 20s would he feel himself quite truly on the earth. At that age he perceived somewhat more sharply the distinction between day and night. A man saw in the case of his own being an evolution which progressed by stages of 6 or 7 years. This harmonized for him with the course of the moon, not that of the sun. The moon, which appears during a period of 28 days, first full and then less illuminated, harmonized for a man with what he himself experienced through the number 6, 7 in his own course of life. One had the feeling, what the moon does in 1 month, a man does in 28 years, 4 times 7 years. This was expressed in the external reckoning of time. After 6 years, a seventh intercalary month was inserted. Men reckoned by the moon, not by the sun. Moreover, men did not look upon external nature as we do today. Today, while we are awake, we see external nature in sharp outlines, unspiritually. At that time, men saw external nature both by day and by night, only not in sharp outlines. They saw nature spiritually, aurically. Today we see everything by day, nothing by night. This is expressed in the fact that we attribute to the sun the importance of causing the distinction between day and night. This importance did not belong to the sun for the ancient Chaldeans in their mystery wisdom. But the moon possessed this importance because this showed in its form a copy of that through which man himself passed in his growth. Men then gave more attention to man and his evolution. One then felt oneself quite differently as a child, as a youth, and as an adult, whereas today one does not feel this at all. There is no longer so great a distinction between the first 7 years and the second as one looks back upon them. Today children are already clever, oh, so clever that one cannot get along with them at all. We must think out special methods of education, even to manage at all with the children. They are as clever as their elders, and indeed all men are clever alike, no matter what their ages may be. Such was by no means the case in ancient Chaldea. The children were then spiritually such that they still remained encased within the divine spiritual, and a man was aware later that while he was young, he still remained within the divine spiritual and only afterward became earthly, crept out of the auric egg. A man did not reckon by what the sun caused, but counted by the moon, in the pictures which the moon showed in the sky arranged in an order of sevens. According to these did men count. It was for this reason that men interjected 1 month each seventh year, a practice relating to the moon. But these external indications of the evolution of civilization, the fact that we reckon now by intercalary days, and the Chaldeans did this with intercalary months, indicates in reality that the distinction in consciousness between day and night did not exist for the ancient Chaldeans, but in its place immense distinctions in consciousness between individual ages in a man's life. Today we say, as we rub the sleep from our eyes, I have slept. The ancient Chaldean awoke in their 21st year, 22nd year, became clear in their perception of the world, and said, I have slept up to my 21st or 22nd year, believing that they would live in a waking state into the 50s, but that they would not by any means fall asleep later as old men, but would come into a far more luminously conscious life. For this reason, old men were looked upon as those who were wise, who now passed with all they had acquired since the 20th year into the world of sleep, but there became unusually clairvoyant. Thus the ancient Chaldeans experienced 3 states of consciousness. We experience 2, the third merely indicated as the dream state, the states of waking, sleeping, dreaming. These 3 states the ancient Chaldean did not experience thus in the interchange of day and night. He experienced a dim, sleeping consciousness till his 20th year, then a consciousness in which he lived with the world, a waking consciousness, in which he said he had awaked up to the 50s. Finally, a state in which others said of him, he takes his earthly consciousness into the spiritual world. He is now such a person that he knows more than other men. Men looked up to the aged as those who possessed knowledge. Today we do not do so. Today we look upon the aged as old simpletons who have become feeble-minded. Just this is the great distinction that penetrates into the very constitution of man's life. This distinction one must clearly understand, for it has a tremendous significance for the being of man. One learns to know the world only when one understands what was the state of consciousness existing in childhood, for example, in ancient Chaldea. It was like, that is, it was not like, but it bore a resemblance to, our dream state. But it was a far more living dream state. It was a dream state in which men did things. Today this occurs as a diseased condition. What is nowadays an illness was among the ancient Chaldeans a state of consciousness of children. And the daytime state, which we today experience in such commonplace Philistine fashion, was also not yet existent. I say Philistine, for the fact that we perceive all men within their physical outlines is really Philistine. Certainly this will not be admitted, but it is true. This state was likewise not yet existent in ancient Chaldea. But one then saw men, as I have explained to you, physically and aurically, and in old age one saw through man into the soul. There was a third state of consciousness which has now been obliterated, for with us it is that of dreamless sleep. The one may be compared with the other. Thus, when we consider the matter historically, we see that the farther back we go, the more do the different states of human consciousness that we meet differentiate themselves. Whereas today we can certainly make no great display with the states of consciousness we possess in ordinary life. What man experiences when he sleeps without dreaming is considered of no value whatever, for he generally has very little to relate about this. Even today there are still a very few persons who are able to tell us what they have experienced in dreamless sleep, but of such persons there are exceedingly few. Dreams, men say, are fantasies, and they consider the waking state as the respectable state, that which one can, in a measure, lay hold upon. Such was not the case with the ancient Chaldeans. The state of consciousness of childhood, with its living dreams, which even directed one's activities, was considered the state in which children still remained half encased in the pre-earthly life, in which when they said something they could tell one what pertained to the divine world. One listened to children because one had this knowledge. They had brought much with them out of the divine world. Children were then looked upon quite differently. Then came the state of consciousness in which men were of the earth and yet of the soul as to their auras. And there was also the state of consciousness of the aged. When one listened to them, one had the clear realization that one was learning something about the spiritual world, that information was being given to one as to what was happening in the spiritual world. And as to those who went higher and higher in the mysteries, of these it was said, when they are 50 or more years old, they rise above the merely solar and enter into the truly spiritual. From being sun heroes, they become fathers, fathers who stand in relation with the spiritual home of humanity. I have wished thus to point out to you, on the basis of history, how different states of consciousness exist in man. In order that we may consider the states of human consciousness, let us first set aside the state of dreamless sleep in the contemporary man, and consider what is quite familiar to all of you, the ordinary waking state which you possess when you say, I am awake, I see objects round about me here, I see the other persons, I hear them speak to me, I have dealings with them, etc. Then let us take the second state with which also you are all familiar, in which you consider yourselves asleep, but in which dreams arise out of sleep, often very frightening, often wonderfully satisfying, of which you have to say, if you are in a sound condition of life, these are things not belonging to the ordinary life of our day, which come into existence and weave themselves out of some sort of natural fantasy, which throng upon man in the most varied ways. The utterly commonplace person will pay little attention to dreams. The superstitious person will receive them from them some sort of external meaning. The poetic person, however, not commonplace and not superstitious, still pays attention to this wonderful dream-weaving and dream-life. For something there forces its way up from the natural deeps of the human being, which is not to be interpreted, of course, after the manner of the superstitious person, but which, nonetheless, points to the fact that even the sleeping person still experiences something from his natural being that rises like clouds, like mists, as, indeed, even mountains rise in the course of long ages and again sink away. Only in the dream experience this all passes quickly, whereas in the universe forms rise and sink away slowly. Dreams have still another characteristic. We dream of snakes coiled about us, of snakes, indeed, that crawl about our bodies. Especially may those who take cocaine, for example, in a harmful way have this dream of serpents in an especially intense form. Whoever yields himself to the vice of eating cocaine will have dream serpents crawling out of all the angles of his body in his dream perception, even while he is not asleep. Thus we may say that we look upon dreams of the kind thus described. When we pay attention to life, we shall always see that there are dreams of such a character as to indicate to us that something within our own bodies is out of order. When we have such serpent dreams, we infer a digestive disturbance. The windings of the digestive organs are symbolized in the dream perception by the windings of the serpents. Or someone dreams that he goes for a walk, and he comes suddenly to a place where an absolutely white pillar suddenly rises up, which is, however, defective at the top, a white stone pillar, a stone column which at its top is defective. In his dream he becomes ill at ease about the defective upper part of the pillar. He wakes, the toothache. He feels unconsciously compelled to take hold of one or another of his teeth. Parenthesis, I refer to the ordinary man of today, not a man of ancient times who lived above such things. Parenthesis. A man belonging truly to this age says, "Now I must go to the dentist. A small filling is needed here. This tooth is defective." What then has happened? This whole experience of the tooth, accompanied by pain, which represents a disorder in the entire organism, images itself in a symbolic picture. The tooth is a white pillar, somewhat defective, somewhat crumbled away. In dream pictures, we become aware of something really within ourselves. Or we may dream vividly, on the contrary, that we are in a room and that we are entirely unable to breathe. In our dream, we get into an inner unrest, which is, however, entirely a dream experience. There, we have not seen it before, in a corner stands a stove that is extremely hot. It is excessively heated. Oh, now we know in our dream why we can't breathe. It is hot in the room. All this in a dream. We awake, we have a throbbing heartbeat and a very rapid pulse. The circulation, which has become disordered, is symbolized thus externally in the dream. Something is there, something that is in ourselves. We become aware of it, but we do not become aware of it as during the day. We become aware of it in symbolic pictures. Or, on the other hand, we dream that somewhere outside the windows the sun is intensely bright. But the sunlight disturbs us. We become restless in our dream over the shining sun with which we are ordinarily pleased. We wake, the neighboring house is afire. An external occurrence symbolizes itself not as it really is, but in an entirely different picture. Thus we see there is a natural creative fantasy in dreams. The external expresses itself in dreams. But we need not stop here. The dream may aspire, so to speak, to have its own inner significance and essential being. We dream of something or other, and the dream, which is, of course, represented to us in pictures, cannot be traced back to anything external. When we gradually get hold of the thing, we say that an entirely different world has been expressed in the dream. There are other beings in action here. We encounter a demonic or beautiful elf-like being. So that not only is our ordinary physical world of the senses represented pictorially in dreams, as this exists within us and outside us, a world entirely unlike our own may also find its way into our dreams. Men may dream in sensible dream pictures of the higher supersensible world. Thus the present-day man has the dream consciousness side by side with the customary consciousness. And one must actually say that susceptibility to dreams makes one a poet. Men who cannot dream will always remain bad poets. For in order to be a poet, and especially to be an artist in any realm of art, one must translate into waking fantasy that which appears naturally in dreams. One, for example, who dreams in such a way that external things are symbolized for him, as the burning house next door was symbolized by the sun shining into the room, will feel impelled to compose music on the day after he has had such a dream. He is a musician. One who experiences his own heartbeats, let us say, as a baking hot stove will feel impelled on the next day to model or to create an architectural form, he is an architect or sculptor or painter. These things are bound together as I have pictured them. In ordinary consciousness, the thing remains at the point I have described, but it is possible to go further. One can develop this ordinary consciousness, as I have explained in my books, in Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, or An Outline of Occult Science. One can develop the ordinary consciousness by following certain soul exercises. We shall have occasion to speak further of these. So that one renders the whole life of thinking, of feeling, of willing more active by giving oneself over to certain very definite conceptions and also combinations of speech until the thoughts become like tangible things, the feelings like living beings. I shall have occasion later to describe this. Then something comes about which is the beginning of a modern initiation. Then it comes to pass that we continue to dream, even by day. But here I have come to a point where misunderstanding easily occurs. Anyone who quite naturally falls into dreams by day, he and his dreams are not to be especially prized. Only one who, in spite of his daydreams, is as wide awake as are other men, and yet can go on dreaming, because he has rendered feeling and thinking far more active within him than these are in other men, only he begins to be an initiate. When one has arrived at this point, the following comes about. One still sees, since one is a rational man, not less rational than others during the day, does not do all sorts of odd tricks because one is dreaming, but is just as sensible by day as other rational men. Then one sees a man, on the one hand, as he exists to the ordinary consciousness, sees the shape of his nose, the color of his eyes, the neat or ugly condition of his hair, and the like. One sees everything. But then one begins to dream something else round about the man, to dream the aura, and to see spiritually the inner spiritual significance of conduct between men. One begins to have in full waking consciousness significant dreams possessed of reality. Dreaming does not cease when one wakes in the morning. It continues even till one goes to sleep, and then during sleep it is transformed. But it possesses meaning. That which one then sees in men is truly there as to their souls. What one sees in conduct is truly spiritually there. One is engaged in an activity such as occurs otherwise in mere reminiscence or mere dreaming, but one is dreaming spiritual reality. A second state of consciousness has been added to the first. Daydreaming becomes a higher perceiving of reality than is ordinary vision in commonplace life. One sees during full waking consciousness something added to ordinary reality which is a higher reality. Dreaming takes us away from reality. It gives us only a fantastic patchwork. But what is dreamt by day in the manner described, in which everything mingles, parenthesis, the individual human forms mingle in it, the animals, the plants mingle in it, parenthesis, where human action takes on meaning to our perception, so that spiritual content lies in this action, all this gives us something in addition to ordinary reality, makes this reality richer. And now there is actually added to what is perceived in ordinary consciousness a second something, and we begin to see the world in an utterly different way. This perceiving otherwise manifests itself most strikingly when we look at the animal kingdom. This animal kingdom now appears to one in such a fashion that one says, "But what, then, have I really been seeing hitherto? I have seen only a part of this world. What I have heretofore been seeing is by no means all that pertains to the animal. Indeed, I have seen only the external part of the animals." An entirely new world is added to that of the animals, so that for every species of animal, for all lions, for all tigers, for all the various animal species, there is something which resembles a human being, which really resembles a human being. So an animal type becomes something very peculiar. It can scarcely be represented in the form of a human being, but I pray you to do this in the following manner. Imagine that you have in a certain way supplemented your body. Bind a thread to each finger of your hand, 10 threads, and at the end of each thread a ball at a certain distance painted over, let us say, with all sorts of figures. Thus you have 10 such cords. Then set up a tremendously nimble play of your fingers, so that these make all possible sorts of motions. Now do the same thing with your toes. Tie a thread to each toe and a ball which figures at the end of every thread. Now accustom yourself to spring so skillfully and to move the toes so skillfully that something quite wonderful results from this form. Every finger is much longer and has such a ball at its end, with figures on it, and every toe has the same thing. Imagine that you see this now in connection with your human form. Your soul controls all this. Every ball is a unit, but in the moment when one sees all this, one believes that all this belongs together. You are not so united with the balls and cords as with your fingers and toes, yet you control the whole thing. It is all a unity. When you begin to manage all this as I have described, then you see above there the lion's soul, and the individual lions hang from it like the balls. This is a unity. Previously, when you have the 20 balls lying at rest and look at the 20, this is then a world in itself. But you now come and add the man to this, add the whole inner mobility to it. Then it becomes something quite new. So it is with your perception. You see the lions moving about singly. This is like the balls lying about. Now you look at the self-conscious lion soul, which is indeed like a human being in the spiritual world, and you see the single lions as if attached like the balls. You have risen to an entirely new order of being. And thus do you ascend likewise to new orders of being for everything in the animal kingdom. Animals also have something pertaining to them that is of the nature of soul, as have men, only this is not in the world in which man has his soul nature. When men go through the world, they bear their souls quite obviously about with them, on the earth, in full self-consciousness. You can throw your self-consciousness at every man's head. A lion cannot do this. But there is a second world. It borders on this world in which we can throw out self-consciousness at every man's head. Above there, however, the lion souls do this. For them, the single lions are only such dancing balls. So that, especially when we observe the animal world in its real being, we are astounded by a consciousness that we have acquired. A second world is added to this. Then we say to ourselves, indeed, we as men are also really in that world, but we draw that world down to the ordinary earthly world. The animal leaves something up there, his species soul, his group soul, and goes about on the earth with only that which moves about there on all fours. We draw down to the earth what the animal leaves up there. We receive thereby a body otherwise formed than that of the animal, but we draw that element down below. Thus we may say, what is within us belongs to this higher world, only we as men draw it down to the earthly world. Thus you see, we become acquainted with an entirely different world, a world which we perceive first in connection with the animals. But we must have a different consciousness. We must bring the dream consciousness to a waking state. Then we shall be able to see into something further which exists in the animal world. One who can do this calls this second world the soul world, as contrasted with the physical world, or the soul plane, the astral plane, as contrasted with the physical plane. This astral plane or astral world, as contrasted with the physical world, is attained by means of a different state of consciousness. We must therefore familiarize ourselves with the fact that different states of consciousness enable us to see into worlds that are not the world of ordinary life. One can advance still further in the energizing of the soul life and the strengthening of its forces. One may not only meditate, concentrate, as I have described this in the books previously mentioned, but one can strive to put again out of the soul that which one holds there as a strong content of soul. Thus, after having first intensified the life of the soul with all one's might, after having rendered thinking and feeling very strong, one now reduces all this again to a weak condition, reduces it to nothing. Thus is established the condition which may be called that of the, quote, empty consciousness, unquote. Now, in the ordinary state of consciousness, when a man renders his consciousness empty, he falls asleep. This can be tested experimentally. We have a person, we deprive him first of sensations through the eyes so that he is in the dark, we deprive him of all sensation of hearing so that he is in silence, is without sound. Then we strive to take away also the other sensations. The person will gradually fall asleep. But this is not the case when a person has first strengthened his thinking and feeling. He can then quite voluntarily empty his consciousness, and he remains awake. He does nothing except what he chooses to do. He remains awake of his own choice. He does not fall asleep. But he no longer has before him the sense world. He no longer has his ordinary thoughts and memories. He has an empty consciousness. But there enters immediately into this empty consciousness a real spiritual world. Just as the sense world, with its colors, its tones, with its opulence of warmth, enters the customary day consciousness, so does a spiritual world enter into this empty consciousness. When we have first made our consciousness both awake and empty, we are surrounded by a spiritual world. Here again we can become aware in a very striking way of this new consciousness and this relationship to a spiritual world through something in external nature. As we have previously become aware in a sense of the second stratum of consciousness through the different manner in which we perceive the animals, so we can now become aware of this changed consciousness, the appearance of a new stratum of consciousness, through the entirely changed manner in which we perceive the plants, the plant world of the earth. How do we perceive the plant world in ordinary consciousness? We go about over the earth, we see growing out of the mineral earth the wealth of colors and the verdure of the plant world. We rejoice in all that blossoms forth in blue and yellow and red and white, all that lives in green. We become aware of all this carpet of the plant world. We let it work upon our sensibilities. Inwardly it becomes alive. It becomes an inner joy. An inner jubilation arises as we see this wonderful covering of plants spread over the earth and rising from the earth. Now we look upward. Overhead we see the sun, which dazzles us. We look into the blue pavilion of the sky. We see nothing more than is offered to us by day when we have a cloudless or a cloudy day, with which all of us are quite familiar. We do not know at first the relationship between looking at the plant carpet of the earth and then looking upward. But we can go still further. Suppose that we have experienced the profoundest inner joy in this carpet of plants, which in the form of the plant world covers the earth. On a beautiful day we wait till the coming of night. Now we look upward at the pavilion of the sky. We see the stars in manifold ordering, gleaming in figures, spread over the whole extent of the sky, sparkling, glittering. A new jubilation of the soul begins, something that acts upon us from above, which sends down from above into our souls a jubilation of inner rejoicing. Thus by day we may point to that which grows on the earth, in the colorful carpet of the earth, in the plant world, a perception which penetrates us with an inner joy and jubilation. Then we can look up, can see the sky which by day shines blue over us, studded by night with sparkling, glittering stars. We can inwardly rejoice over that which reveals itself from above in our souls. This applies to the ordinary consciousness. If we have developed that consciousness, which is empty yet awake, into which the spiritual world has broken, we then say to ourselves as we cast our glance by day over the plant covering and by night look upward to the gleaming, sparkling stars, indeed, by day, that which covers the earth as a carpet of colors has fascinated us, has penetrated us with inner rejoicing. But what have we really seen by day? Now by night we look up to the heavens with their gleaming stars. No longer do the stars merely sparkle before this waking, empty consciousness, the consciousness empty as to the earth. The stars take on the most manifold forms. The mere sparkling of the stars has ceased. And there above us is something wonderful possessed of essential being. There growing, weaving life spreads everywhere, great and mighty and exalted. We stand in a knowledge that is worship, in a worship that is knowledge. Truly we have reached a middle stage of initiation, and we say to ourselves, plants, these are primarily there above. The real plant being is that which has hitherto rayed out to us in single points as the stars. Now it is truly as if the real plant world were there, overhead. It is as if the violet appeared to us, not as a violet, but as if from a violet in the morning, when it is filled with dew, we should see, gleaming, not the violet, but the single dew pearls. When we see only the single stars, the single dew pearls are there sparkling in the stars. Behind these there exists in truth a mighty weaving world of essential being. To this do we look up. Now we know what the plant world is. It is by no means on the earth. It is out there, in the cosmos, mighty and exalted and powerful and great. And what is that which we have seen down below by day in the colored flower covering? What is this? This is the mirrored reflection of what is there, overhead. And we know now that the cosmos, with its life of weaving forms, with its essentially real life of forms, that this mirrors itself on the earth. The earth in its outer surface is a mirror. When we look into a mirror, we know that this is only a mirrored image of ourself. There we stand. We are mirrored, just as we are in external form. The soul is not in this. The heavens do not mirror themselves in the earth in a manner so entirely adequate, but in such a way that they gleam in the plant colors, yellow, green, blue, red, white. This is the mirrored image of the heavens, the weak, shadowy image of the heavens. We have learned to know of a new world. Overhead the plants are men, beings possessing self-consciousness. We have added to the ordinary physical world and the astral world a third, a truly spiritual world. The stars, indeed, with their dew pearls, are the cosmic dew pearls of this world. The plants are the mirrored image of this world. They are not all that exist in the plants. Indeed, in what they show us on the earth, they are not even real beings, but mere mirrored images, in contrast with the endlessly multiform reality, rich and intense, which is there above in the real spiritual world, and out of which the single stars gleam as the cosmic dew pearls. We have now a third world, really spiritual, and we know that all this splendid plant nature merely mirrors this world. Now also we learn to know how we as men bear likewise within us what is the essential being of the plants there overhead. Only we bring down into the mirror life of the earth below what the plants leave there above. The plants remain above in the spirit land. They send to the earth their mirrored images. These mirrored images the earth fills with matter, with earthly matter. We men bear our soul element, which also belongs to that world, here, into this mirror world. We are not mere mirrored images, but are even now on the earth soul realities. We live on earth, first of all, in three worlds. In the world of the physical, in the world in which the animal, with his self-consciousness, does not live. But at the same time we live as men in a second world, in which the animal with his self-consciousness does live, in the astral world. Only we bear this with us down to the physical world. We live also in still a third world, in the world in which lives the truth of the plant beings in the spiritual world. Only the plants send to the earth merely their mirrored images, and we our soul realities. Now you may say, a being that has here on earth body, soul, and spirit lives with body, soul, and spirit in the physical world and is man. A being that has on the earth body and soul, but has its spirit in an adjoining world and is therefore less real in the physical world, is the animal. A being that has in the physical world only its body, in the second world its soul, and in a further third world its spirit, so that the body is merely the mirrored image of the spirit, only filled out with earthly matter, this is the plant. You know in nature three worlds. You know that man bears these three worlds in himself. You feel the plants in a certain sense growing all the way up to the stars. You look at the plant and you say to yourselves, thou art a being of whom I see on earth only the mirrored image void of real being. The more I turn my look upward, look at the stars by night, so much the more do I see the real being there above. Nature becomes whole when I look from the earth up to the stars, when I view the cosmos as one. Then I look back at myself as man and say to myself, what reaches in the plant even up there, this I have compressed within me even on the earth. I bear within me as man the physical, the astral, the spiritual world. To see into this, to grow with nature even up to the heavens, to grow inwardly in man even to where the heavens reveal themselves in him, this means to ascend to spiritual research. The end of Lecture 2.